May it please the court, good morning. Patrick Collins for Ronald Brooks. To answer the court's question, yes, this court should adopt a bright line rule that requires an accomplice testimony instruction when the state presents testimony that includes, when the state presents a case that includes the testimony of an accomplice.
Does that bright line rule apply whether or not that accomplice testimony is corroborated?
Yes, Your Honor, it should.
Second question is, and then you can explain why it should if you like. The argument against it generally is it takes tactical discretion away from defense counsel, that there may be a circumstance under which defense counsel would not want an express cautionary charge on accomplice testimony. Can you envision a tactical decision where defense counsel would not want that charge, that the bright line rule would somehow take away from their tactical discretion or options?
I can't really conceive of a situation where accomplice testifies for the state adversely to the defendant where defense counsel would not want the jury to be particularly cautioned on how to view that accomplice's testimony. I would concede that such a case may exist out there or may someday exist.
We've assumed that it does because defense counsel doesn't always ask for it. And that's what gets us into this mishmash of results at the end of the day that we're trying to wade through. We're trying to envision some circumstance as a matter of policy where we should not institute a bright line rule because it would detract from counsel's ability to decide whether or not they want the instruction. The danger of bright line rules is they apply in every case by definition, and sometimes they work, sometimes they don't.
Your Honor, in the three most recent cases, which I think get us into the mishmash that I can think of, that would be Smith, Hoskins, and then my case, Mr. Brooks' post-conviction case. In all three cases, trial counsel failed to request the instruction by means of oversight, and that's what gets us into the mishmash more often than...
Could defense counsel decide as a matter of tactics that the last thing that I think I can demonstrate to this jury that this accomplice is tainted, not credible, and the last thing that I want to have happen is to have the judge say, picking up on your comment on the evidence argument, that if you find him credible, ladies and gentlemen, you can convict.
Well, I think the instruction has to say that, Your Honor, because...
But do you want a judge to say that? Could you imagine a scenario where you would not want a judge to say that?
Well, perhaps I'm not imaginative enough, but I can't personally envision a scenario where I wouldn't want the judge to give an instruction that gives a special caution to the jury about the state's accomplice.
But the instruction has two parts.
Right, and then the second part would be, I would see it having three parts, actually, Your Honor. First part is great care and caution. Second part being look to corroborating evidence, if any, to help you make a decision about the witness's credibility. And then finally, you, the jury, are the sole determiners of credibility, and you may choose to believe or not believe the accomplice.
I
would want the first two parts in there no matter what, I think. So I think the whole instruction still would be appropriate.
I've got a suggested situation where you might not want that, and that is where the accomplice testifies for the state and says all the right things as far as the state is concerned. But on cross-examination, you're able to, indicate that this accomplice is not necessarily testifying to the truth, and then maybe get one or two comments that are favorable to your side. Isn't that a possibility in an accomplice testimony?
I think it's a possibility. I think it actually happened at trial in the case where I represent Mr. Brooks.
In which case, arguably, defense counsel would say to themselves, this witness wasn't entirely favorable to me, but a couple of points that he made are things that I'm going to be able to use. So I don't want the jury to be told this is an accomplice, view his testimony with great caution.
In that case, Your Honor, and I do see your point, I think that that would still be better left to closing argument by the defense to make whatever arguments they felt was appropriate about how the jury could and should perceive the testimony of the witness in various parts.
In which case you wouldn't want an automatic instruction, right?
Well, I would still want the instruction to say that no matter what degree of care and caution you view the witness with, at the end of the day, you are the sole determiners of the credibility of any witness, be that an expert,
well,
an accomplice.
Mr. Collins, just to follow up on the questions of the other justices, if the defense counsel decides deliberately not to seek an accomplished instruction for tactical reasons, that's not problematic as long as that's an established fact. It doesn't create an incompetence of counsel issue.
Well, I think that
I would have thought that was a given.
To the Chief Justice's point and Your Honor's point,
I'm just asking about the case where it's a tactical matter, defense counsel deliberately doesn't want and therefore doesn't ask for an instruction.
I think under Strickland, if there's a waiver on the record and then an affidavit saying that it was for tactical reasons, then no, I don't think that would be problematic in that context.
Okay. And to go to the other end of the spectrum, if counsel doesn't ask for an instruction and there is no tactical reason, then that raises the Strickland issue,
yes,
and which is the mess that we frequently get into.
Right.
Isn't there a way to have, basically, to avoid either extreme by, instead of requiring an automatic instruction, requiring the trial judge to inquire of defense counsel on the record whether or not defense counsel wants an instruction?
Yes, Your Honor. I think as long as it's on the record, that would solve the issue. As long as trial counsel, in conferring with his or her client, makes a tactical decision, to Justice Berger's point, and makes a waiver on the record, and otherwise it would be given in every single case where an accomplice testifies.
Well,
I think that would address the situations that the court presents.
Well, it addresses it only in part, unless counsel is further asked, why don't you want it? And because counsel could say, no, Your Honor, I don't want the charge. And then, as counsel frequently does today, as soon as a motion for post-conviction relief is filed, they fall on their sword and say, yes, I was incompetent. I should have said, yes, I want the instruction, not, no, I don't want it. So that makes it incumbent upon the trial judge to say, state your reason why you don't want the charge on the record. And if defense counsel doesn't give a credible reason for not wanting it, we've got a record to work with. Right now, our problem is we don't have a record to work with, and we're making this assumption that there may have been a tactical reason for not requesting the instruction without inquiry into under what conceivable circumstance could counsel not have asked for the instruction.
Your Honor, twofold response to that. One is, I think if a trial attorney represents to the court that it's for tactical reasons on the record, then that would alleviate the down-the-road problem.
Well, without explaining what the tactical reason is under a factual circumstance where there's no credible basis for a tactical reason for not asking for it?
Well, I suppose the case would exist where that would raise the eyebrows and cause concern for the court.
Well, consider them very raised.
Yes.
Because I am concerned about being trapped by counsel who's not absolutely forthright at the time the question is asked, saving, as counsel can easily reconcile to themselves they should, saving an argument for post-conviction relief.
Right. Well, I can see that that's a possibility, Your Honor. In the cases...
Well, that's one possibility that a bright-line rule will out forever.
True.
We don't have to get into that gamesmanship about is it plain no, is it no for tactical reasons, or is it no for tactical reasons, which I will now explain.
in the case that's before the court today, Mr. Brooks' case, and in Smith, the two recent post-conviction relief cases, both of those trial counsel did state on the record via affidavit that it was inadvertence and simply their failure to request such an instruction. And I think what the court's saying is perhaps that can't always be accepted at face value, and then we have problems down the road. I understand that, and that a bright line rule would certainly address that situation. And perhaps stating the reasons for not requesting the instruction, or a better way to put it would be rejecting the instruction, put on the record would certainly be appropriate in certain cases. But I would say, Your Honor, that I think those cases would be few and far between, not that they're not worth addressing, but I think they would be few and far between in terms of the, by and large, issue that occurs trial after trial when accomplices testify.
Where do we stand with Brooks? Do you take the position that there wasn't a complete and sufficient charge given and that there was no corroborating evidence of the accomplice testimony?
No, I do not. I take the position that Brooks's case is one of those cases that cries out for a bright line rule because there was some corroboration of some charges, not of other charges. The corroboration pertained to certain counts but not others. Some of the evidence that got Mr. Brooks convicted came solely from Rose Epps, the accomplice, who was charged with all the same charges that Mr. Brooks was and ended up getting a conspiracy second plea. So, no, this is not on the bland end of the spectrum where there was absolutely zero corroboration. There was some corroboration, but the jury needs to know how to ferret out that information and how to assess a witness of which they should be suspicious by looking at corroborating evidence, if any, and then making a determination. I've used up some of my rebuttal time, Your Honor.
You want to save the rest?
I would prefer to save the rest if that's acceptable to the court.
Thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the Court, Kate Aronson on behalf of Appellant Rashawn Owens. Good morning. I agree with Mr. Collins and Appellant Brooks that, yes, there should be a bright-line rule. In Smith, this Court said that a reasonably competent attorney knows the law. And in Bland, the Court articulated the appropriate instruction when there is accomplice testimony. I can conceive of no case in which an accomplice testifies that a defense attorney would not want the bland type instruction that addresses not only the great, suspicion and great caution with respect to the inherent untrustworthiness of accomplice testimony, but also the lack of corroboration or the corroboration aspect of the jury instruction. With respect to Mr. Owens's case, I'm on direct appeal. I filed a motion on behalf of Mr. Owens for a new trial prior to this court's decision in Smith versus State. The opening brief for Mr. Owens was filed before Smith versus State. The state highlighted in the supplemental briefing that this court has traditionally reviewed the failure of a trial judge to give a specific jury instruction under a plain error standard. When this court decided Smith, this court said it's better for post-conviction review. It's Mr. Owens's position that this court should consider, under the plain error standard, the merits of the case rather than deferring it to post-conviction proceedings. With respect to Mr. Owens's case, this is the paradigmatic bland situation. There was no physical evidence linking him to the robbery of the bank. The only evidence was the internally inconsistent statements of Ray and Martin. The statements because they each gave multiple statements, and those multiple statements varied. Those statements that they each gave conflicted with one another, and the statements that they gave were not in any way corroborated by four bank tellers who were all witnesses to the event. To go back for a moment to Justice Berger's question, an accomplice testifies as a witness for the state. The accomplice's testimony, if credible, if determined to be credible by the jury, is inherently damaging to the defendant. Making one or two points on cross would not in any way, I submit, make the accomplice jury instruction not be appropriate in light of it's an adverse witness who's called, and it is a witness for the state who leaves the jury with information which the state views as critical or material to its case in an effort to convict the defendant.
Does that last comment presuppose that there is no corroborating evidence, that is evidence corroborating what the accomplice is testifying to?
It does not presuppose that there's no corroboration. The problem with these cases, as it's developed in the most recent cases, is that some cases have a bit of corroboration, some have none, some have a lot. So you're on a spectrum of corroboration.
Right, and doesn't that suggest that the more the corroboration, the less damaging the accomplice's testimony will be, and the reverse? If you have no corroboration, then certainly you'd have great risk.
Correct.
If you have a lot of corroboration, that risk should go down if the corroborating evidence is genuine and on its own persuasive.
If there is significant corroboration, it makes the failure to instruct the jury with a Bland-type instruction less prejudicial, if I was following the court's question. Yes, I agree.
I want to be sure I understand your position. Where is Owens' case on that spectrum?
Owens' case is in the Bland category, wherein you have no independent corroboration from any eyewitness at the bank. You have no independent corroboration by any witness of information given by Martin and Ray regarding how the plans were developed, who participated in the robberies, what happened after the robberies. I mean, to give the court an example.
Well, is it just so I'm clear on what the record does show, is it accurate that Martin and Owens were apprehended in possession of the proceeds of the robbery?
Correct, as was Mr. Ray, and Mr. Ray was not charged with the robbery of the bank here in Delaware. Only Martin and Owens.
And is it accurate that Owens had purchased a handgun before the robbery?
He had purchased legally a handgun 5 months prior. That handgun is the same gun. Strike that. That handgun was a single barrel. Sarah Arnold, the customer service representative in the bank, who is held at bay at gunpoint, described the gun as double-barreled. No witness from the bank identified that gun as being the gun used. That gun is subsequently located at someone else's house by the name of Troy Wiley. State doesn't call Troy Wiley and say, Rashawn Owens brought that gun over, dropped it off, and said, hey, I just used it in a bank robbery. Can you hold it for me? So the how and when it got to Wiley's house is only developed by Martin, the accomplice, and no one corroborates it. So the fact that he buys a gun 5 months before legally that's not identified in this, and no one corroborates how it gets there or whether it was involved, is exactly the reason why the complete bland structure was appropriate in this case.
And when you have a scenario where an accomplice to one robbery but not an accomplice to another robbery testifies about an admission about the other robbery by the defendant, is that person an accomplice to both robberies for purposes of bland or not?
With respect specifically to Mr. Owens' case, are you referring to the statement that's made?
Yeah, I'm referring to Ray, who testified that Martin and Owens had told him about the robbery and that he had helped them to get rid of the tainted proceeds.
Well, that's interesting because the statement that Martin gives first, if I can address that very briefly, is Owens is in the bank, and as he's leaving the bank, he looks at all the tellers and says, "Have a nice day." Not one teller corroborated that statement by either of the two bank robbers on the March 28th. It's completely uncorroborated. With respect to Ray's statement that Martin explained to Ray that a robbery occurred and that defendant said, "Have a nice day," that came from Martin to Ray and was not corroborated in any way by anyone at the bank. I don't know if I answered the court's question. I apologize if I did not.
I'll accept it.
Just let me make sure that I'm clear on the procedural part of it. I don't know whether procedural is the right word, but you're asking this court to reach a decision on the failure to give a bland-type instruction without this being a post-conviction motion.
Correct. This the state cited actually a number of cases wherein the court has reached that recently, and Doherty being the alibi instruction case, I believe. It was raised on direct appeal, and the court reached it under a plain error standard, which has been the tradition, at least in jury instruction cases, prior to Smith. Prior to Hoskins. Unfortunately, in Hoskins, even though Smith had been decided, the court said, "Well, you're in a direct appeal situation. Save that for post-conviction." And for purposes of not only judicial economy and the fact that in Smith this court said no reasonably competent attorney wouldn't know the law, and considering the facts and circumstances of this case, no reasonably competent attorney could explain why he failed to ask for that instruction in this case. I think the analysis is plain error, and the court can reach it in its decision as opposed to deferring it for post-conviction proceedings. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning. I'm pleased to court Timothy Donovan for the state. Beginning with Mr. Owens, it's the state's position. Well, it's a fact that the judge did give an accomplice credibility instruction. At the time of trial, the last words on the subject were both Bordley and Solomon. Both of those expressly improved the pattern jury instruction that the judge gave. So I don't understand how it could be plain error for the judge to give the pattern jury instruction that was expressly improved by this court at the time of trial. On that that instruction was, of course, adequate to guide the jury in assessing the credibility of this particular witness, Mr. Martin, who was a co-defendant. And that the jury did that, I think the proof of the pudding is that the jury acquitted the defendant of the first robbery in which Mr. Martin's testimony was wholly uncorroborated. They convicted him only of the second robbery, in which the defendant, Mr. Owens, was caught 1 week after the robbery, along with Mr. Martin and Mr. Ray, with the red-stained proceeds of the robbery, in which there was corroboration.
You're talking about Owens' case now.
This is Mr. Owens' case.
So your position is that the instruction that was given followed the pattern jury instruction, and to the extent it didn't elaborate, at least given the state of the law at the time.
At the time, this was
It would be a harmless error at best.
At best, it would be harmless error. However, the I note in Smith, now which is the case that both of my colleagues are relying, the court in Smith emphasized that a adequate accomplice liability instruction has to accomplish two goals. It has to single out the credibility of the company for special consideration. That was done here. And then it has to direct the jury to consider whether or not the testimony is corroborated by other evidence in the case. And the pattern jury instruction does that also.
So what was missing here is the great caution, suspicion language.
That, of course, in my memorandum I have, and that is the language. You should consider this testimony with suspicion and great caution.
No, I'm just trying to understand the record. You know, when Mr. Collins was talking, he said he's looking for three things. The pattern in jury instruction does 2 out of 3. Is that right?
Yes. Well, actually, I'm reading from, so this is the ideal instruction. That this court, these are the two goals of this accomplice credibility instruction, according to the court in the Smith case, to accomplish those two things. And my position is that the pattern jury instruction does that. It both focuses the jury on the testimony of this particular witness to the exclusion of other witnesses as an accomplice.
And all right, so just so you and I understand each other, you're saying it does that even without the great caution or suspicion language.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. And so I understand you and Justice Holland in this shell game. I'm trying to find out under which shell is the P. Is this pattern instruction given in this case the bland instruction or something different?
If by a bland instruction, as is very often argued by defendants, a bland instruction includes the language, you shall view the testimony of the accomplice with suspicion and great caution. That's the issue that comes.
Okay, that's what I thought. So this pattern instruction is not the bland instruction.
It's not the bland instruction because it eliminates that language.
Okay, and the bland instruction, at least the bland case, has been around for what, 41 years?
Since 1970.
Why doesn't the pattern instruction comply with bland?
In 1974, as this court pointed out in Boardley, the committee, which was also responsible for the Delaware Code, the new Delaware Code, made up all the pattern jury instructions to be followed to go with the code and eliminated from the pattern jury instruction that portion of the bland instruction with suspicion and great caution. From then on, it has not been there.
So if we were to construct a miracle, and that is this opinion, whatever it may be, were to finally resolve all the issues about accomplice liability instructions and what they should contain and why, would you suggest to us that we revisit Bland?
Yes, to the extent that the suggested instruction in Bland told the jury to view the accomplice testimony with suspicion and great caution, yes, and to make clear, as the court suggested in both Boardley and Solomon that language is not necessary, and simply say it definitively it's not necessary. So,
well, in Smith, didn't we say it was preferable, or maybe even a little stronger?
Well, I've argued in my memorandum that it's not even preferable. That's for the jury.
What do you think we said in what do you think we said in Smith about using Bland?
The court then went on to quote a portion of the instruction that did not contain that language, which elaborated on the necessity of corroboration or the desirability of corroboration. That's fine. And corroboration, of course, is very important in an accomplice testimony case, and the more corroboration you have, the less important the accomplice testimony instruction becomes. So under, say, a plain error or a Strickland standard, if there's ample corroboration, as there was, say, in the Brooks case, which I would feel comfortable arguing sufficiency of the evidence before the court, even if Ms. Epps hadn't testified. So ample corroboration in that case. So the failure in that case for counsel, through oversight, as counsel said in his affidavit, to request the instruction would, under the Strickland standard, as the Superior Court ruled in denying Rule 61, was non-prejudicial. And, in fact, I believe the Superior Court judge said, considering the amount of corroboration, I can see why counsel didn't even bother asking for one, because of the ample corroboration through video surveillance and just who these people were. Mr. Brooks has no job. Ms. Epps is working two jobs. Mr. Brooks is the only one who was ever seen driving the car. Mr. Brooks was seen both by the police and with video taking the cow print bag in which all the evidence was found. And testimony of Mr. Tomchick, who sold the defendant himself, three of the four guns found in the cow print bag in exchange for money and crack cocaine. I mean, there was ample evidence here that Mr. Brooks was a drug dealer and that the evidence found in the cow print bag was his and his alone.
Mr. Donovan, if you were to accept the premise for sake of argument that our law currently in this area is like a child's board game. You roll the dice and you either take the left fork, the center fork, or the right fork, depending on what the dice say. Why isn't the solution to the problem to have a bright line rule that says, we're stopping this nonsense. This will be the instruction wherever there is accomplice testimony offered, regardless of the extent to which there's corroboration, regardless of whether this issue comes before us on a direct appeal or post-conviction relief. There are multiple charges. There's no way to get through a situation of analysis where counsel might want it or not want it under these circumstances or want it to apply to some of the charges but not all of the charges. Why isn't the problem just forever solved with having a bland instruction mandatory whenever an accomplice testifies?
Again, I think Your Honor did mention that there can be cases where defense counsel simply doesn't want that instruction. And this court has always looked to defense counsel first and foremost to request instructions, specific instructions that defense counsel wants for and may not want for specific tactical reasons. And when the state puts an accomplice on the stand to testify as a state's witness, the state's not guaranteed as to what that accomplice is going to say, and it's absolutely
well, you're guaranteed you're going to get there if there is one, a pre-existing before trial statement of the defendant in. You have it both ways, frankly.
If we have the statement ahead of time, and then the defendant, and then the accomplice gets on the stand and either will not testify, or will say, "Well, yeah, I gave that statement, but I lied," or testify minimizing everybody's involvement. There's all kinds of ways this can happen, and defense counsel is going to want to say, well, you see, ladies and gentlemen of the jury, when Mr. Co-defendant took the witness stand under oath and faced you finally, he finally fessed up that statement he gave the police was just a bunch of nonsense.
Mr. Donovan, I'd like to ask you a question about, two questions about the instruction given in Owens. First of all, you referred to, at the time, the law supported giving that instruction, and specifically that was Solomon versus State,
Solomon,
where that very language was upheld on appeal. Is that correct? All right. And secondly, that language in that instruction, has the Superior Court since adopted that as the pattern instruction for accomplice testimony?
Since 1974.
The language in Solomon?
No, I'm sorry. The language in the pattern jury instruction. Under Bordley, in Bordley, the court traced the history of that pattern jury instruction to 1974, when I believe the court said Chief Justice Wolcott at the time was a committee, and they made up these pattern jury instructions.
Let me ask it this way: is it accurate, is the pattern jury instruction, revised Delaware Criminal Code pattern and jury instructions 4th? The exact instruction that was used in Owens and in Solomon.
I believe it was. Both are quoted, and I have the pattern jury instruction, and they seem to track each other.
As to that language, do you have any quarrel with that language?
No, none whatsoever. Right. Absolutely not. None whatsoever. The issue that we get, and by we I mean the Attorney General's office, both in direct appeal and the Rule 61, is that you should view the testimony with suspicion and great caution. That is what is typically called, well, we didn't get a bland instruction. No, you got a bland instruction. You just didn't get that specific language. And that specific language has been dropped out of the pattern jury instruction and has been approved by this court. Now, initially, it was the first thing that dropped out was with suspicion, but great caution. Then the great dropped out of caution. It was just with caution. And then the whole phrase dropped out. And Superior Court, since at least from Bordley, has been giving the pattern jury instruction as it is, where that sentence is missing entirely. But it's the state's position that the pattern jury instruction is the one that should be given.
And what did this court say about that in Smith?
In Smith, the court said bland instruction, but then went on to quote the portion of the bland instruction and did not include that language, but the portion that elaborated on the role of corroboration. So in the pattern jury instruction, that's just one set. That is listed among the factors the jury should consider, including the interest of the co-defendant, whether co-defendant has accepted the plea bargain, and then whether there's any corroboration supporting the co-defendant's testimony. And in the portion of the Bland case that this court quoted is, without such corroboration, you should not find the defendants guilty unless after careful examination of the alleged accomplice's testimony, you are satisfied beyond a reasonable doubt that it's true and you may safely rely on it. Of course, if you are not, and so on. So it just, I think, underscores more than the pattern instruction the importance of corroboration.
But isn't it fair to say that Smith held, we acknowledge there's pattern instruction exists, and we acknowledge that we've approved it in the past, but we think the bland instruction should be the text of the instruction given when an accomplice testifies?
I think the court used the word the best practice. Best practice would be to give the bland, and I'm assuming since this is the portion that was quoted, this is the portion of the instruction that the court was approving rather than the language that comes up again and again and again when people complain they didn't get bland instructions, sufficient and great caution.
Mr. Donovan, I just have a factual question about the degree of corroborative evidence in both the Brooks and the Owens case. I think you told us that there was a substantial amount of independent corroboration in the Brooks case. Is that right?
Brooks and the drug.
And how would you characterize the corroboration in the Owens case?
Not as substantial. That was primarily the fact that the defendant was caught.
Well, if we were to, this is all metaphorical, but if you were to compare the degree of corroboration to where the needle is on the fuel indicator, would it be half full, one quarter?
Well,
where would it fall?
As I mentioned, in the Brooks case, the Epps was corroborative of other evidence in the case. In other words, I think
that was a full tank corroboration.
I would feel comfortable arguing sufficiency of the evidence if Ms. Epps hadn't testified at all. Obviously, with the bank robbery case, you can't prosecute that case. Or you would have to stand before the jury and say, well, look, Mr. Defender was caught with the proceeds of the bank robbery 1 week after the case.
You're talking
therefore,
about Owens?
He robbed the bank.
You're talking about Owens now?
I'm talking about Mr. Owens, yes.
Okay.
Without Quinn Martin's testimony, we would have Mr. Owens in possession of stolen goods 1 week after the case. Now, there used to be a presumption, I suppose now it's an inference, that one caught in caught with stolen goods within a relatively short time after the theft is presumed now is, there's a permissible inference to be drawn that that person stole the goods, but I would certainly feel very uncomfortable arguing to a jury that they should convict based on that evidence and that evidence alone. So that's the Mr. Martin's testimony was essential to the prosecution of this case. Ms. Epps' testimony was certainly very helpful, but it was not absolutely essential to the prosecution of that case.
Should it make a difference in terms of whether an instruction has to be given and what the instruction should be, where you have the two differences in the cases we have before us, where one, as you say, the accomplice testimony was just a very minor part of all the evidence that was presented, versus Owens, where you've just said that Martin's testimony was essential and that you couldn't even prosecute the case without it. So that would seem to be the most extreme type of fact pattern for telling a jury what it ought or ought not to do with this accomplice testimony. Wouldn't you agree?
I would, and which is why the judge, sua sponte, in this case, was just gave the accomplice credibility instruction, because the judge realized that Mr. Barton's testimony was so significant, and the corroboration was, I mean, there was corroboration, but certainly not enough corroboration to prosecute the case without Mr. Barton's testimony.
Mr. Donovan, I don't think we've ever adopted a bright line rule on an expert witness instruction when a case has an expert. But can you imagine a case where an expert is qualified and testified in the case and the jury is not given an expert witness instruction?
That if the expert's testimony is considered like any other testimony in the case. Again, whether that's error or not, or whether it's a plain error, whether it's harmless error, is going to depend on how significant the expert's testimony is.
Yeah, but I mean, when there's an expert, the jury is almost inevitably given an expert witness instruction.
That follows automatically. I mean, that's...
So the question we're struggling with here in our supplemental memo is, if we have an accomplice, is there something to be said for saying you get an accomplice instruction?
I mean, again, this would be more of a defense counsel kind of problem, and the state certainly has no objection to this being done automatically. But defense counsel may. Now, of course, the ball could be put in defense counsel's court. You're going to get it automatically unless you say you don't want it. I mean, that could be the rule. See a Rule 61 in which the defense counsel was ineffective or failing to object to the accomplice credibility instruction.
Let me make sure I fully understand what you just said. You have no objection, the state has no objection to an automatic instruction on accomplice testimony. But I take it from your earlier argument you would object to one that included the bland caution, suspicious language.
That's the only, as far as the form of the instruction goes, that's the only language.
What you've indicated is the pattern instruction that we apparently approved in Bordley and is the product of an initiative by this court in the first instance, as you've described the history, the institutional history behind it. That pattern instruction you would not object to being given in all circumstances.
No.
In which an accomplice testifies.
No,
regardless of the amount of corroboration or lack of corroboration.
Okay. None whatsoever. I mean, it could have been very easily given in the Brooks case. Whenever an accomplice testifies, it should be. I see no problem whatsoever arising from the state's perspective now, for that instruction to be given automatically. But again, again, from defense counsel's perspective, may have an objection. They may not want it under particular facts or circumstances of that particular case. They may want to use part of the, again, a witness who goes south or something like that. There may be times when defense counsel does not want that instruction.
So going back to the two cases we have before us, your position is they should both be affirmed. Brooks on a harmless error type theory because of the sufficiency of the corroborating evidence.
No.
And Owens because the instruction that was given was generally accepted at the time.
At the time, that was the generally accepted instruction, and in Brooks, there's no ineffective assistance of counsel because certainly fails to meet the prejudice prong of the Strickland standard. Thank you.
With respect to what the accomplice jury instruction should be, I submit that the court should look back at the reasons behind the decision in Bland. In Bland, the court said a jury can convict a defendant on an accomplice's testimony only without any corroboration. However, the jury should be instructed that when assessing an accomplice's testimony, this is what the court or the jury should consider. And the difference between the pattern jury instruction given in the Owens case versus the Bland instruction is that it's missing not one piece, but rather two pieces. One being to address the policy issue of if we're going to allow a jury to convict a defendant without any corroborating evidence based solely on the accomplice's testimony, then we need to highlight as a policy matter and instruct the jury exactly how to view that testimony, i.e. with caution and suspicion. And the second policy behind it being that the absence of corroboration in and of itself requires special consideration. And the language that the state that wasn't given in this, that's actually in the Bland case, is that after careful examination of the alleged accomplice testimony, the jury must be satisfied beyond a reasonable doubt that that testimony is true and that they may safely rely on it to convict the defendant.
I think earlier you told us that Owens was tried before Smith was decided. Is that right?
Correct.
So Bordley would have been out, and the question is, how do we say that it was plain error to give the instruction in Owens' case, given the state of the law before Smith?
Because this court held in Smith that Bland has never been abrogated or overruled, number one. Number two, that this is so close to the Bland-type situation wherein there is no corroboration, that the appropriate instruction had to be more specific than the pattern instruction.
Let me ask you about what seems to be a point of disagreement between the state and the defense here, and that's this language, with suspicion and great caution. The federal instruction, as I understand it, does not use that phrase. Is that correct? Or do you know? Let me read to you what at least I found that the Second Circuit found should be given. The testimony of any informer who provides evidence against the defendant for pay must be examined and weighed by the jury with greater care than the testimony of an ordinary witness. Does that accomplish what you're looking for? With greater care than the testimony of an ordinary witness?
In the joint supplemental memo, we referred to the Third Circuit, the Third Circuit pattern jury instructions. Those instructions still utilize the caution language, and that is, I don't agree with the court that the Second Circuit would be satisfactory, that that great caution and suspicion language that this court proposed 40 years ago is the better instruction. because of the inherent untrustworthiness of the accomplice testimony.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. Unless the court has any other questions.
No. There was just some confusion in my notes about who was going to take rebuttal and how much time, and I take it you've taken the rebuttal and we're finished. Okay, that's all I needed to know.
Thank you.
Thank you. We'll take the case under advisement and recess.